Morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Cochran, Judge Gaetis, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this 20th day of January, 2021. We are ready to begin our oral arguments this morning, which are being conducted on the Zoom platform. I'm not sure if the attorneys are familiar with how we do hearings on Zoom. I will let you know that our procedural rules are the same. Appellants will have 15 minutes for primary argument, respondents will have 15 minutes for rebuttal argument, and appellants will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's my understanding that respondents are going to split their time with Mr. Bowman arguing for 10 minutes first, and then Ms. Brahma completing the argument with 5 minutes. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. You'll notice that we have a timekeeping device up in the corner of the screen. Please be mindful of your time. What I will do is for each side, give you about 3 minutes to start your argument. Assume that we're familiar with the facts and the procedural history, and that if we have questions about those aspects of the case, we'll ask. In that 3 minutes, it would be helpful if you could, to the extent possible, identify the relief you're seeking and your reasons for it. And if any argument in your opinion is stronger than another, let us know what your priorities are. And at that point, we may interrupt for questions. And during the arguments, we may also interrupt for questions by either vocally interrupting you or raising our hand. So please do pay attention to the images of the judge on the screen. So you're aware of when a judge has a question. And each attorney should be sure to introduce his or herself immediately before beginning their argument. And now that we've got those housekeeping matters out of the way, we're ready for the first case in the matter of the trade secret designations of 2019 cogeneration and small power production reports. We'll hear argument first for attorney for appellant. Who is arguing for appellant?
Good morning, Jeffrey Hammonds.
Thank you. You may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. Jeffrey Hammonds for the appellant, and today we are seeking reversal of the Public Utility Commission's decision below. The issues presented today are simple. Can a monopoly public utility evade a plain language public inspection requirement by claiming trade secret protections for its avoided cost data? The answer is no. And did the Public Utility Commission commit a legal error by interpreting the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act to trump that public inspection requirement? The answer is yes. I have three main points today. First, the plain language of Minnesota's public inspection regulation at issue is straightforward and means what it says. Second, the purpose of that public inspection requirement requires full transparency, and that includes no trade secret designations. And third, I will touch on why there is no conflict between Minnesota's public inspection requirement and the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. So first, the plain language of the regulation at issue supports reversing the commission's decision below. Both state and federal regulations require monopoly electric utilities to file on an annual basis their avoided cost information and make it, quote, available for public inspection. That plain language compels only one outcome, and that outcome precludes any action that would render any portions of those annual filings no longer available to the public. As a result, because trade secret designations render information non-public, they are precluded by Minnesota's public inspection requirement. And second, the purpose of that public inspection requirement also supports reversing the commission. To allow monopoly electric utilities to withhold its annual avoided cost information from public view runs contrary to the purpose of that public inspection requirement and discourages development of independently owned renewable energy facilities. When Congress enacted the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, also known as PURPA, it did so to encourage development of those independently owned renewable power plants, not discourage them. Pursuant to that goal in 1983, the Public Utility Commission promulgated the public inspection regulation at issue because it found that restricting access to the annual avoided cost information would frustrate the purpose of PURPA by discouraging development of qualifying renewable facilities, which is an outcome the commission in 1983 found would be unreasonable. The transparency created by that public inspection requirement is necessary to further PURPA because it allows prospective qualifying facilities to make informed business decisions and provides them the information necessary to obtain the financing in order to construct their renewable energy projects. The AMICI Solar Energy Industries Association brief in this matter goes into more detail on how solar developers need that information. And lastly, there is no conflict between the public inspection requirement and the Data Practices Act. The commission was frankly mistaken. The Data Practices Act contains an exemption for administrative regulations that classify certain categories of information as public. And as a result, the Minnesota public inspection requirement is the exact type of regulation envisioned by that inspection, and therefore there is no actual conflict between the Data Practices Act and the plain language of the public inspection requirement. Furthermore, this harmony between the Data Practices Act and Minnesota's public inspection requirement evades a potential federal preclusion issue where the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, who has a similar public inspection requirement and has found that that inspection requirement does require full public disclosure, by finding harmony between the Data Practices Act and Minnesota's regulation, it evades any preemption issues. And the outcome today is simple. The phrase, quote, available for public inspection means what the plain language commands, and the Data Practices Act is not in conflict with that requirement, and in fact, they're harmonious. And for these reasons, the commission's decision below should be reversed. Thank you.
Council, I'll begin the questioning. I'd like you to first address the argument that's been made that appellant lacks standing to bring this claim before the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. Appellants have standing for two reasons. One, the public inspection regulation at issue creates a public right to access to this information. So anybody who's denied that access has standing to bring a complaint. Furthermore, as organizations specifically aimed at seeking to encourage development of these independently owned renewable facilities, we're uniquely harmed because we requested access to it. And after three rounds of comments and three different hearings in front of the Public Utility Commission, we were ultimately denied that access. And so not only do we have a right created in the regulation at issue, but we also have a right because we were harmed by the commission's decision.
If I can follow up, Mr. Hammonds, on your response. So is the harm you're alleging harm related to public availability of the information, or is it a harm related to the organization's mission to encourage development of renewable energy?
It's both.
I think I only heard you talk about the first and not the second.
Yes, it's both. It's the harm to us as members of the public to be denied access to this, and we're uniquely harmed because our mission is to seek development and encourage the development through policy advocacy around independently owned renewable facilities in Minnesota, and so our lack of access harms our ability to pursue that mission.
And on that point, is there any evidence in the record that the trade secret designation of this information has discouraged investment in renewable QFs, qualified facilities?
Yes, the AMICI Solar Energy Industry Association and also the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association goes into more detail to that. But the basic premise is, in order for an independently owned renewable facility to obtain financing from a bank or other investors, they need to be able to show a certain prospective revenue stream in order to obtain financing to construct those projects. Just like if you went to a bank to buy a car and told the bank, hey, I know how much I make this year, but I have no idea what it's going to be the next year or the year after that, the bank's going to be hesitant to loan to you. It's the same thing when you're trying to build a renewable energy project. The information at issue here includes forecasts of avoided costs, not just their avoided cost at any given year. And so developers, as the AMICI talk about more, can take that information to reduce the risk of their investment enough to obtain financing.
Where in the commission's record would we find that? Can you point us to the specific record number references to find the information that you're referring to, you've referred to in your last answer?
So the Solar Energy Industry Association, their briefing talks about this. They didn't provide comment in the commission proceeding itself, so I can't point to anywhere in the record for that.
Okay, thank you. And go ahead. I'll ask my other question later. So thank you, Judge Larkin.
My question concerns standing and your response. You have ably described hypotheticals in which a qualified renewable facility that sought to develop might not have access to the information it needs to obtain financing to pursue development. But is there any information in the record indicating that any developer or proposed developer of a qualified renewable facility is actually trying to get this information that's protected in this case to pursue development of a facility? And I'm concerned that it sounds like you're describing possible harm that may arise, and that's a legitimate concern, but I don't know if that possibility of harm or that hypothetical is sufficient to establish standing under Supreme Court case law.
Well, the standing that we're alleging is not on behalf of prospective qualifying facilities. It's on behalf of our own organization. And because the public inspection regulation at issue creates a public right, it's not just limited to qualifying facilities. If it was, standing, I think, would be more of an issue. But because it creates that public right, and it's important to understand why it creates that public right, because it actually is envisioning future hypothetical qualifying facilities, because in order to become one, you have to be able to know whether or not the economics are there. And you can't do that if you don't have access to this information. Under PURPA, anybody can become a qualifying facility. If you went and purchased a solar panel and put it on your house and you wanted to take advantage of the commission's PURPA tariff, you could, because there's no minimum size requirement. As long as you're generating electricity with renewable sources, you can do that. And so right now, you would have no idea whether or not you could do that in the first place, because under the current commission's decision, you can't have access to that information that would enable you to even make that decision. And so that's the harm that we're concerned with. But the harm for us specifically as well is the fact that, because we believe the regulation commands anybody should be able to have access to this information, we were denied that access. And so that's a legal harm to us that supports our standing in this case.
So is your argument that you've been conferred standing under statute to the extent that there's a public right of access?
Under the regulation, because it creates a public right, yes. We would argue that because okay, we're being...
That's not a statutory grant. I mean, in terms of conferring standard or standing, it could happen pursuant to a statutory grant or an injury in fact. It doesn't sound like you're describing an injury in fact, and you're not citing to any statutory entitlement to the information. You're citing to a regulation. Do you have any case law that kind of equates a right under a regulation with a statutory grant of standing?
I do not, but the injury in fact is to us, our mission is to, one of the things that we could do if we had access to this information is to be able to distribute it to other organizations, both qualifying facilities and also other organizations in Minnesota that would be able to use this information to see the economics for being able to develop these projects under the commission's tariffs. We're not allowed to do that because we can't have access to it. So the injury in fact to us is the denial of that access.
Thank you.
I just have one additional question relating to standing. The Supreme Court has said with regard to organizational standing, which I think is what you're arguing here today, that there's two key questions to analyze. One, if they were denied standing, would that mean that no potential plaintiff would have standing to challenge the regulation in question? And two, for whose benefit was the regulation at issue enacted? Can you address those two questions?
Well, yes, I would have concerns if we're denied standing, who would be able to bring this, because our claim for standing partially relies on this public right to be able to review and inspect this information. But then secondly, to whose benefit this was created? The benefit was created for the public because, like I said, anybody could become a qualifying facility in the future. And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has a similar regulation that uses the same language, and Minnesota actually just adopted their regulation. And so they have made clear in their own interpretations of public inspection that it's available to the public. There's full public disclosure. And so So this was created for the benefit of anybody in Minnesota to be able to access this information.
As I understand your argument, it's that, well, you would obtain the information, you might share it with proposed developers of qualified renewable facilities, so that would further the purpose. But I'm having a hard time with your response that no other plaintiff could bring this claim. Isn't the obvious claimant a proposed developer of a qualified renewable facility. In other words, someone who says, I'd like to explore this possibility because I might develop a qualified renewable facility, but I can't get access to the information I need. Isn't that the obvious claimant? And why are we to conclude that that claimant might not come before the PUC and raise the issue and then before this court?
I think that could be a possible claimant, but I don't think that, you know, like I said, our claim for injury is the fact that we don't have access to this information. And so, because there could be other claimants who could bring different type of injury claims, I don't think should preclude us from getting a decision on the merits of what this regulation requires, which its plain language can really only compel one outcome. And it's the one that we're seeking today.
Could I, directing your attention to the merits, as I understand the case law, a statute such as the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act trumps a regulation or a rule when there's a conflict between statute and rule. Could you address that case law?
Yes, and that's correct. But we don't actually think there's a conflict between the two. There's an exemption in the Data Practices Act for administrative regulations that classify certain categories of information. And that's exactly what this particular regulation and issue does here.
Is that the exception that talks about information for a judicial proceeding?
It says, let me find the specific language. It refers to both judicial proceedings, but also administrative rules pertaining to the conduct of legal actions. And so that's what this regulation does. So every year the utilities file a petition at the beginning of the year to seek approval for their tariffs, and there's a 30-day timeline where anybody can file comments, either objecting to the sufficiency of that, which is what we did in 2019.
So it's your position that what you're describing is a legal action?
Yes, it's a legally docketed proceeding in the Public Utility Commission that has a whole set of rules that govern it, what has to be in the filings, and also the grounds for objecting to the filings, which is what we did.
Is there a distinction? Mr. Hammonds, is there a distinction between an administrative action and a legal action?
Well, in this case, the administrative action is a legal action because it's the utility seeking a legal approval of their tariff filings and the sufficiency of their avoided cost information, and we filed objections to that. So I don't think I can speak to sort of how far out the definition of legal action goes, but in this case, it's very clearly a legal action, and it's very clear that this public inspection requirement is regulating the conduct of those actions because it's determining what must be in them in order for the utility commission to approve, and we objected to the sufficiency on the grounds of that particular regulation.
Do either of the judges have any questions on the merits? Counsel, I'm going to give you another 5 minutes. We took a significant amount of time discussing standing, and I do recognize that there are several other issues. So I want you to have time to air those arguments on the merit. So I'll give you another 5 minutes and we'll adjust respondents in accord. You may proceed.
Thank you. One of the other things I wanted to talk about is the commission, other than erroneously interpreting the Data Practices Act, we also think misconstrued the statutory background. So there is a Data Practices Act, but there is also Minnesota legislature's PURPA statute that they enacted, and that statute commands the Public Utility Commission to act in a manner that encourages development of these qualifying facilities consistent with the interest of ratepayers. What they effectively did was they, under the guise of arguing under the protection of ratepayers, ignored the encouragement of qualifying facilities. As we've talked about a lot already today, this information is necessary for prospective qualifying facilities to make informed business decisions. Without access to that, you can't develop at all. And so as the commission in 1983 found, if you don't have public access to this information, it would be unreasonable because it would discourage development. And so you have a general statute of applicability, the Data Practices Act, but then you have the specific Minnesota PURPA statute, and the commission in 1983, when it adopted this public inspection requirement, was acting pursuant to that. And in order to read them both in harmony, the only reasonable outcome in our opinion is that the Data Practices Act doesn't conflict with a duly promulgated regulation that is copied from a federal regulation and pursuant to Minnesota statute.
But that brings us back to the issue of, I mean, it's one thing to talk about a conflict between two statutes, but you're describing a conflict between a statute and a regulation. And case law says that in that situation, the statute controls. I'm not sure if you've answered my concern regarding that.
Yep. We don't think there's a conflict. Like I said, the exemption we think is squarely intended to capture regulations like the one at issue. And so we don't actually think there's a conflict. We think that the commission erred in finding a conflict to begin with. We think they're
So there's only a conflict if a person reads those regulations as applying to judicial proceedings as opposed to administrative proceedings.
Yes, because the statute itself doesn't just refer to judicial proceedings. It also refers to administrative legal actions, which in this particular case is what the commission's decision below was pursuant to.
And could you just clarify, you said the statute refers to administrative legal actions. Which statute are you referring to? The Data Practices Act?
The Data Practices Act, yes. Yeah. Section Minnesota Statute 1303, subdivision 4. That's the exemption. It refers to either judicial or administrative rules. So it's not limited to just judicial rules. And so the last thing on the merits to just briefly talk about is the harm that the commission relied on in order to support its designation of trade secrets is speculative, and there wasn't any evidence in the record to support it. The utilities and comments put forth the argument that if this information is available to the public as the regulation requires, that somehow ratepayers would be harmed, but we just disagree with that because there wasn't any evidence put forth to support it. In Minnesota, the way procurement of new energy facilities works is you put out a request for proposal and developers then bid, and then the lowest cost developer that meets the requirements of that proposal wins. It's a reverse auction. And so by making this information available, it doesn't actually impact how those auctions are ran at all, because you're still bidding against other people. So whether or not you have access to avoided cost information, which the statute or the regulation allows you to have anyway, that doesn't help you beat your competitor across the street from winning an auction in the first place. And so that's the only ground the commission found any potential speculative injury could fall. And we think it flies in the face of how energy procurement actually works in the state. And so we don't think even on the merits of the decision of whether this is trade secret information or not, we think it fails for that reason.
Mr. Hammonds, I'd like to ask you about the preemption issue. The commission and the utilities argue that assuming the Data Practices Act applies, or they argue the Data Practices Act applies, and let's assume it does, and that this information is properly designated trade secret under state law, that compliance with both the federal rules and the state law is possible because of 18 CFR section 292.302D, which provides for a substitution or an alternate method of filing data or providing data. Can you address that argument and whether compliance with both state and federal law is possible reading those two together?
Yes, assuming that the Data Practices Act applies, which we does, but we do, but we don't think there's a conflict. But assuming there is a conflict, then we don't think it's possible to comply with both state and federal law for two reasons. One, the Minnesota regulation at issue adopts the same language, and it's essentially the same regulation as the federal one that requires public inspection. Because FERC has found that requirement is full public disclosure, then any state decision to the contrary would be preempted. But second, the argument about 18 CFR 929302D, substitution of alternative method, that requires a specific legal process before the commission can actually seek refuge in that exemption. And as the record had demonstrated, the commission has never done that. It requires two things. One, it requires public notice of their intent to substitute their method, And then two, it requires the commission to notify the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that it has made a determination to substitute the method. In 1983, there's no such intent for this public inspection requirement or the annual filing requirements to do that. And none of the amendments to those regulations since have ever once cited to or even sought to provide refuge in this. And so right now in Minnesota, both the federal regulation and the state regulation regime are applicable, and they should be read in harmony together as a result.
Thank you, Council. Your time is up. You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal to address the arguments of respondents. And as I indicated, I'll give each of the attorneys for respondents additional time. Mr. Marshall, is it possible to set the clock at 12.5 minutes for Mr. Bowman? And if not, we'll just allow him to go over 2.5 minutes. This is a new system to us. I apologize for having to ask. Excellent. Mr. Bowman, you may proceed. Please do state your name for the record first.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jeffrey Bowman. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Minnesota, and I represent the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission in this matter. This case is about the Minnesota Public Utility Commission's decision to allow three Minnesota utilities to designate a limited amount of utility cost information as trade secret pursuant to the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act and annual reports filed with the commission. In deciding this case, the Public Utilities Commission solicited multiple rounds of comments and held multiple hearings, taking a hard look at the issues presented. Through that process, the utilities voluntarily made additional cost information public that was not designated public in their initial filings. Ultimately, the commission determined that a limited amount of trade secret designations were appropriate under the applicable law and best balanced the encouragement of small power production and the protection of ratepayers. The commission determined that the release of protected cost information to the public could increase cost for utilities and ratepayers and was appropriately classified as trade secret and deserving of protection. This court should affirm the commission decision for three reasons. First, allowing trade secret redactions in the otherwise public annual filings is consistent with the applicable law. Second, allowing limited trade secret protections properly balances the encouragement of small power production and cogeneration while maintaining important protections for ratepayers. And three, relators have not established that the commission's decision is preempted by law. And before I go into the body of my argument, I want to pause there on that point, because as the judges noted in questioning relators, we have hypotheticals in this case about developers being denied financing. We have the arguments of counsel about financing being denied, but we don't have any evidence before the commission that developers are being denied financing because of the lack of an avoided cost data, or because, or that this somehow frustrates cogeneration or small power production. And this issue permeates all issues in this case. It permeates the standing issue. It permeates our interpretation of the statute, and it also permeates the preemption issue. And so that's very important that this information was never presented to the commission. Commission decisions have to be based on substantial evidence, and there's simply no record evidence in front of the commission that the purpose of PURPA was frustrated by the commission's decision. Moving to my first point, allowing trade secret redactions in otherwise public annual filings is consistent with the applicable law. Minnesota Rule 7835-1200 provides in relevant part that the annual filings must be available for public inspection. Relators ask this court to read that public inspection requirement and simply end its analysis there and order the entirety of the avoided cost data within the annual filings to be public. This is improper. Although the rule classifies the documents itself as public, this does not define the scope of the data which is classified public within the document. The interpretation of 7835-1200 cannot proceed in a vacuum. The interpretation of this rule must be made in context, and it must be formed by other applicable laws. Specifically, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act protects trade secret information. Trade secret information is defined as data supplied to the government, that is subject to reasonable efforts to maintain its secrecy and that derives independent economic value from not being generally known to the public. Here, after multiple rounds of comments and hearings, the Commission found that limited avoided cost data pertaining to the cost of energy and capacity on the utility system met this definition. Specifically, the Commission found that if third parties had access to this data, potential vendors and suppliers could modify their bids and therefore increase a utility's costs. Of course, these utility costs are ultimately borne by utilities ratepayers. The public inspection requirement must also be read in the context of the Commission's own rules, which allow protection of trade secret information in proceedings such as this. The Commission has a specific rule, Minnesota Rule 7829.0500, that allows for utilities to seek trade secret protections in filings such as this. And these are procedures that the utilities complied with in this case. When reading these provisions together, the only reasonable interpretation is that the annual filings are public documents subject to lawful redactions under the Government Data Practices Act. There is no support in Minnesota law for relator's position that if a document is public, there can be no further protections provided for any of the specific data contained therein. And finally, on this
Mr. Bowman,
point,
while the can you address relator's argument regarding 1303 subdivision 4A?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So there are several things wrong with this argument. And the first is that this argument was never presented in front of the Commission. So despite multiple rounds of briefing, multiple rounds of comment, multiple rounds of hearing, relators never once presented the argument to the Commission that either the MGDPA was inapplicable or that there was a specific provision of the MGDPA that forced this data to change designation. And that's important for two reasons. One, the Commission has never had the opportunity to weigh in on that issue, for briefing to be developed on it, for a record to be developed on that for this court to review. But more importantly, their failure to raise that in a petition for reconsideration procedurally bars them from making that this argument on appeal. The Commission has a very specific statute, 216B.27, and it acts to statutorily bar arguments on appeal that were not specifically raised in a petition for reconsideration. I don't think there's any dispute here that this argument was not raised in the petition for reconsideration. I think relators try to argue that it was somehow a sub-argument of some other general objection to the data being classified as trade secret. But again, specifically, this argument was never raised. There was no briefing on it. And so this court doesn't have or shouldn't reach that issue under the statutory direction. And in fact, if you look at other cases involving 216B.27, in re the application of Minnesota Power Authority to increase rates for electric service, this is 2019 Westlaw 5885069, this court specifically refused to reach an issue that wasn't raised in a petition for reconsideration. So that's the first answer, but also obviously want to answer the merits. And the argument also fails on the merits. So first of all, you only reach this issue about whether data changes pursuant to an administrative rule if you read 7835.1200 to mean that all the data is public, regardless of any other classification. You know, that rule simply isn't as broad or sweeping as relators assert. It says the filings are public, and it doesn't establish that all the data in there is public, regardless of what's going on. And again, that's consistent with the Commission rules. So you don't even reach this issue unless you make a reading of 7835.1200 that I simply don't think is supported. The third part, I guess, is that, again, you have to look at the rule itself, which says judicial or administrative rules pertaining to the conduct of legal actions. And ELPC tries to expand this definition to mean any administrative rule can override the MGDPA. That's simply not what the statute says. We're talking about pertaining to the conduct of legal actions. I think you have to look at that word conduct. We're talking about procedural rules in either judicial or administrative legal actions. They haven't cited any case law that this applies to all administrative regulations. And so we're an example of where this might come up in a court case is that, you know, if someone files a tort case and puts their medical condition at issue, You know, that might be protected as Minnesota government data, but the judicial rules, you've put it at issue and you no longer have protection. So in legal proceedings or legal actions, we have certain rules regarding what data remains protective and what's public. And so really, I think we're looking at, you know, hearing in front of an administrative law judge or, you know, a judicial proceeding. You certainly aren't looking at substantive rules. And that's what this is. This is a substantive rule meant to set cost rates. It's not a procedural rule. And fifth, I've spent way too much time on this, but this is important, is that even if an agency rule could trump a statute, and we don't think that's the case here, you have to keep in mind that the commission has a specific rule, 7829.3200. And so if the commission found that administrative rules could take precedent over statutes, which is a questionable result, we don't have to enforce our own administrative rules. We can vary them if certain conditions are met. So, and those are basically, if we find it, enforcement would be an excessive burden, it wouldn't adversely affect the public interest, and not imposed by standards of law. So even if this court said that somehow this was an administrative rule that could override protections in the MGDPA, then had this argument been presented in front of the commission, which it wasn't, the commission could have looked to the harms to ratepayers occurring in this case and said, we're going to vary this rule. We don't think it's appropriate to impose in this case. So when relators bring up a rule that the commission doesn't have to enforce, and there's good reasons why it might not in this case, as a basis to override protections in the MGDPA, that's an argument that fails, Your Honor.
Mr. Bowman, I'd also like to ask you about the preemption issue. I believe in your brief, you argue that that 292.30D applies to the information that is filed with the commission pursuant to the PURPO rules, state rules, that is. Can you explain to me when or if the commission has gone through any sort of formal process to make the determination required by D1, that the commission has to determine that the data that avoided costs can be derived from the different data?
Yes, Your Honor. So in 1983, we promulgated rules under the 216B.164. And if you look, that order from the commission promulgating those rules is contained. It's cited in the relator's brief. It's at 1983 Westlaw 908113. It details a robust public notice and comment procedure for us to promulgate our rules. It does not specifically reference whether we're proceeding under subsection B or subsection D. It simply says that the commission is implementing 216B.164, so the state law implementing PURPA, and then it also says it's consistent with federal law. So it doesn't speak to whether we're under B or D, but I think if you look at what the commission did, the only result that you can come to is that we're under D, and that's because we didn't object, we didn't adopt B verbatim. We could have. PURPA allows you to implement PURPA rules by adopting them verbatim, but it doesn't require that, and that's not what we did. We required different additional cost data. So since we're not requiring exactly what's under B, we therefore must be under D, and there was a robust public process for that to occur. And Your Honor,
well,
I see I'm
following
out of time.
Up, I'm sorry.
Judge Cochran, please ask your question.
Thank you, Judge Larkin. Paragraph D2 requires that a state regulatory agency notify the commission within 30 days of making such determination. Did that occur?
Your Honor, there is no record of that occurring. I don't have it's not in the record either way. And again, this was in 1983. But what I'll say to that is, I think if you look at D, subpart one is really what the commission has to do to set up these rules. And we complied with D1. I don't think D2 is a condition precedent to having an alternative method. I think relators could argue that in 1983, we potentially didn't do two. We don't know. So but I don't think that changes the fact that we have an alternative method and we've been using it for a really long time. And so if there are no other questions, my time's expired and I ask that you affirm the commission decisions. In the case that you disagree with the commission's rule because of what I mentioned about the variance, I think if the commission decision is not affirmed, then it needs to be remanded for additional proceedings, not simply that this court order the data be made public. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from Ms. Brahma. Please introduce yourself for the record before beginning, and you have 7.5 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Brahma with the law firm of Taft, Stettinius & Hollister, representing the respondent utilities in this proceeding, XL Energy, Minnesota Power, and Otter Tail Power Company. With my time today, I hope to address 3 points dovetailing on the conversations that have already occurred between this court and counsel for the relators and for the commission. First, I'd like to address the fact that the commission did indeed engage in a balancing despite relators' comment here today and addressed both the harm to customers and the public if this data were to be made public, as well as the consideration of advancing small power production and cogeneration. Second, I'd like to touch on relators' lack of standing in this matter. And third, that if the court should find any fault with the commission's decision, the correct remedy is remand, as briefly touched on by commission counsel. On the issue of harm to the public and the balancing of interests, Minnesota Statute 216B164, as has been noted, requires maximum encouragement to cogeneration and small power producers, which in fact describes neither ELPC nor the amicus, but only to the extent that this is consistent with protection of the ratepayers and the public. And it is simply incorrect to say that the commission did not engage in a balancing on both sides of this matter. A review of the commission's decision not only indicates its discussion of the balancing that is required here, but also it didn't accept everything or it had certain requirements that the utilities make certain data public in the future. That issue speaks to the commission's decisions and consideration of both sides of this issue. But the commission also approved the trade secret designations of certain limited data because there are several interests that are harmed here by making that data public. First of all, the commission's order explains in detail why publicizing the data would affect competitive bidding processes, would give bidders on utility generation projects the opportunity to know and price their work above a floor established by certain avoided cost data, thereby raising costs and rates for customers. Second, publicizing this specific data in some cases would involve making third-party subscription data public, depriving those companies and individuals of compensation for their work without and doing so without their involvement. And third, publicizing the specific data that's retained as trade secret here would involve publicizing third-party power producer data that is proprietary regarding their facilities that they own, the utilities do not. The ELPC and the amicus do not address these harms at all. They keep coming back to their own harms, which are, as I will discuss in a moment, both speculative and not related to the purpose of PURPA in this proceeding. And in fact, their proposal to make this data public would in fact change years of practice, decades, as Commission Counsel identified, without a justification for doing so at this late date. Turning to the related standing issue, the standing issue was in fact raised to the Public Utilities Commission through various comments about how the rules are intended to benefit developers specifically, and in Minnesota Power's March 23rd, 2020 comments to the commission, where Minnesota Power specifically notes that petitioners lack standing to even bring these claims without demonstrating harm to their organizations. The first time that relators addressed the potential harm to them is in their reply brief in this court. And in doing so, all they say is that they rely in part on public availability of avoided cost data to advocate for greater development of renewable QFs under PURPA. But neither in their briefs nor today do they describe how they need this data in order to advocate for greater development, nor why lack of the specific data at issue here harms their ability to advocate for the data. They also discussed today for the first time that they would like to be able to disseminate this data. If they indicate this should be public, it's not clear why they would need to be able to disseminate this data in order to advance the purpose in any event. There's really nothing in the record here that would indicate these non-developers are harmed in any way, nor conferred statutory as opposed to regulatory and pursuant to their own arguments, standing to address these issues.
Ms. Brahma,
yes.
I have a question for you regarding standing. As you know, environmental groups participate in a variety of commission proceedings involving renewable energy issues. And I want to make sure I understand that your standing argument here is that these two organizations have not identified any specific evidence demonstrating harm. You're not arguing more generally that an environmental group would never have standing to appeal a commission decision involving renewable energy.
Thank you, Your Honor. That is quite correct. The utilities did not argue and would not argue that environmental groups can never participate. In fact, they participate in a wide variety of organizations and did so here. This is a question of legal standing to contest a specific determination of the commission in this instance, which requires, as this court has noted, either statutory basis for standing or injury in fact. And in this particular case, this particular group, as well as the amicus, have shown neither before the commission or before this court.
What about their argument that the rule is intended to allow public access to the information on their harm because they don't have public access?
I would answer that in at least two parts. First of all, the rule speaks to public inspection of the filings. That does not necessarily equate to finding that every single piece of information in those filings necessarily needs to be made public. If that were the case, we would be talking about the potential for the commission to include all kinds of data that could potentially be harmful to the public if made public. We talk about public filings that the utilities make all the time that include consumer data, social security numbers, and the public inspection or the public filing of that information is about making it accessible generally, not about every single piece of data. And actually a review of the specific rule really gets, and the rulemaking gets at that issue specifically, as it really talks about access through either the utilities holding it in their own facility or making it on file with the commission. That's about physical access, not about every piece of data being available. The one other issue I wanted to touch on very briefly is the remedy here, and that is because in their reply brief in particular, the relators ask that all the data that they contest simply should be made public if the commission's decision is reversed. Not only is that incorrect because the commission could issue a variance, as commission counsel identified, but the basis for this court's determination will require additional assessment of what data, if any, should be made public should the court find any fault with the commission's decision. And even if the court found PURPA preempt state rules, we'd still have to go through that same analysis of what exactly would need to be made public. So while the respondent utilities do not believe any, believe that the commission's decision should be affirmed, we do believe the commission's decision should be affirmed. If there's any fault found, the correct remedy would be remand at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hammond, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. So I'm going to touch on three things that were raised by both the Commission Council and Utilities Council. The first one is the harm that is alleged to become to ratepayers as a result of adjusting bidding practices, which is what the utilities speculate would occur if this information is public. There's no record support for it. The only support for it was unsupported allegations and comments filed by the utilities, and that's it. But going back to what was said earlier in this argument and also in the utilities brief, that this information would somehow create a floor contradicts what I talked about earlier, how these reverse auctions work. So if you've got five people bidding against each other, whether or not they have access to this information isn't going to create a floor because their ultimate goal is to still beat each other. So if five people all decide they're going to bid the same amount, the rational bidder is then going to bid lower because that's how you actually win the auction in order to develop your projects. you have no incentive to set a floor in a reverse auction because then you're never guaranteed to win. But since your only goal is as a competitive bidder is to actually win, you're going to bid as low as you possibly can with the information that you have that you think you can still develop a project and make some money. So whether or not you have access to this particular information is not going to affect your bidding process at all. And the record below doesn't have any evidence to support the contrary. The second issue raised is the issue of waiver and the exemption in the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. We didn't waive this argument because at the outset, we never found that there was any conflict to begin with. But then when it became clear that the commission found a conflict in our petition for reconsideration, our specific argument was that there is no actual conflict between this regulation and the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. And as a result, we haven't waived that at all. And then third, on the merits of the argument, we're not arguing today that any agency can promulgate any regulation that can evade the requirements of Data Practices Act. We're only arguing that when a regulation is specifically regulating the conduct of a legal proceeding in front of the commission or court, that regulation is captured by that exemption. There is no procedure or substantive distinction that counsel for the commission makes that's not in the statute at all. The statute just says administrative or legal actions. As I said at the beginning of every procedure pursuant to this regulation, the utilities file a petition for approval and thus they institute a legal action, and then parties can file comments and objections to those, which we did. And so without having to worry about what is the universe of legal actions, it's very clear that this was a legal action in this case that's covered by this exemption. And there is no procedural substantive distinction. This is both a procedural rule that governs the conduct of this action and what must be made available to the public. And so
how does it govern the conduct of the proceeding? I'm not following that. I mean, the rule requires filing, but that's not the conduct of the proceeding. That's just typical utility filing information with an agency.
The regulation, there's different regulations. The regulation that I'm talking about specifically is about the public availability of those filings. And in this instance, it explicitly requires that they're public. And there's very few instances in the commission regulations. I believe there's only three where they actually have the words public inspection as regards to filing. And this is one of them.
But that doesn't, I still don't follow how that relates to the proceeding. I'm not following that. Explain that.
It relates to, like I said, the public availability of that information and what's contained in that particular filing. And in that way, it is regulating the conduct of that proceeding because it's commanding what in this instance is a small subset of information that must be public. So the last thing I'll just touch on again is the standing. We are harmed by lack of access to this information. This information was not envisioned to be only made available for developers. And if that was the case, then the regulation would state as such. And I think right now what we have is a chicken and an egg problem. If I'm an investor or a developer looking to develop in Minnesota and I know I can't have access to this information that I need to be able to obtain financing, I don't know why I would spend any time even fighting about it. I would just go to another state where I can already get access to this information. And so worrying about—
Wouldn't such a developer have legal counsel or some level of expertise such that they could communicate about ways to obtain the information through a non-disclosure agreement? I feel like it's a stretch to say that, well, developers aren't going to look to develop in Minnesota because they say in this one case, a few things were designated as trade secret. I mean, is there any indication in the record that any developer chose another state because of designation of a small portion of the information in the filing as protected by the Government Data Practices Act?
There's nothing in the record that I know of on that particular point, but more generally, the AMICI, Solar Energy Industry Association, in their brief, they do talk about the resistance they face for even negotiating non-disclosure agreements. But we don't think non-disclosure agreements are a good outcome in this case because it still puts the utility in the driver's seat of determining who can even sign that in the first place. For instance, they obviously wouldn't allow us to sign it because of their interpretation of who they think should have access to this.
Are there any other questions?
Can I ask one further question?
Please, you may, of course.
Council, in respondent utilities brief at page 42, they argue that the information you're seeking, the trade secret information that you're seeking to have made public, is not the information that developers need. And they argue that because the avoided cost rate for a QF of up to 1 megawatt is already public, and that the avoided cost rate for a larger project is, according to statute, the utility's least cost renewable energy facility, or the bid of a competing supplier of a least cost renewable energy facility, whichever is lower. And their argument is that the trade secret information in the 2019 annual filings doesn't give you that information that would set the rate according to 216B.164. So could you respond to that argument? Why is this trade secret information really necessary for developers?
So there's two reasons. One, there's a large universe of developers that are smaller than 1 megawatt. 1 megawatt is actually pretty large. It's a solar farm up to 5 acres. So we're not talking
right,
about small.
But that information is already public, correct?
What is public is the avoided cost rate for that year, but what's also contained in this information are forecasts of future avoided costs. And it's that information, the forecasted information, that you can then take to lower your risk in order to obtain financing. And so it's really the issue in this case is the availability of those forecasted avoided costs, because that's what you can then use to reduce your risk. Because then you can have some certainty of what your rates are going to be in the future, not just this year, but in the next few years. And so that's the information specifically that they would need. So if you're looking to install a solar panel on your roof, you know how much you pay month to month for electricity and how much you're going to get this year. But if you don't have any certainty of what you're going to be getting in the next few years, you're not going to even be able to run the analysis to determine whether or not you're going to break even in the long run. And so that's why you need access to that information that's currently being denied.
Thank you.
All right. That concludes the hearing. We'd like to thank the attorneys for their briefing and their arguments and their answers to our questions this morning. You'll have our decision within 90 days as required by statute. Thank you.
Thank you.